spring, it rained. Over the plains of Kansas and the fields of Missouri, it rained, rained, rained. It rained during 23 of the 30 days of June, with more in July. Telephone workmen called it a frog strangler. Finally, a mid-July deluge in central Kansas pulled the trigger. The soggy soil could take no more. Rivers burst their weakened dikes, and one of the worst floods in the nation's history was underway. On came the swirling floodwaters, down the Kaw, down the Cottonwood, down the Neosho, down the Smoky Hill,
and eventually into Kansas City. This documentary, made by AT&T, tells the story of the flood of 1951, one of the biggest floods that destroyed and shaped parts of Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking about how floods have guided Kansas Cityans in their decisions about where to build a business or a neighborhood and where not to do those things. A lot of what the city looks like has to do with flooding. Later in the show, could new flood control measures change our landscape? That's to come. For now, I'm pleased to welcome historian and journalist Monroe Dodd to the studio. Hi, Monroe.
Hi, Gina.
Let's get a sense of the scale of influence flooding has really had. How would you characterize the relationship between Kansas City as we know it today and major floods of the past?
Actually, it goes back to the relationship between Kansas City and the rivers. You know, Kansas City owes its place on the map to rivers, the conjunction of the Kansas River and with the Missouri River. And because rivers allowed people in the earliest days of European settlement, in fact, for Native Americans too, easy transportation up and down. When railroads came along, they found the grades very comfortable to build alongside rivers. Rivers helped Kansas City prosper, but Kansas City, as you just pointed out, has suffered quite a bit too, because there's a downside to rivers and streams, and that's they occasionally go over their banks. The history of flooding in Kansas City was in some of the earliest floods getting away from it, moving up from it. And in some of the later floods, it was, how do we stop this? How do we put up a wall? How can we keep this flooding out? That's what's gone on for, since merely 1826.
Can you name a distinctive feature of the Kansas City landscape that is where it is and looks how it looks because of flooding or people's fear of flooding?
Union Station is a perfect example. In the late 19th century and until about 1903, the railroads, as I said, came up on the gentle grades along rivers. And so for passenger services, Union Depot, which was built by seven or eight railroads, was perfectly situated down in the West Bottoms. But after the flood of 1903, they realized there were numerous reasons for this. But one of the big reasons they realized that Union Station is where it is that, gosh, this place is flooded. We had stuff within a yard of the globes hanging down the lights from the ceiling, covering up passenger signs. It was useless for weeks. Let's build it on higher ground. So this Union Station we know today is on high ground, relatively.
Wow. And when was that built again?
The Union Station opened in 1914.
Huh. Well, let's back up. As settlers were arriving in this area, was the threat of floods something that they thought about? I mean, you've talked about that eventually people started moving away from the river, but you don't have to have already lived by a river to know that a possibility of a flood exists there.
That's right. But I think most of those early settlers probably believed, well, let's see, our odds are good. They're not perfect, but they're good. And gosh, we can certainly move these packs of fur downstream, where they were trading with the Native American tribes for furs. We can move them downstream to St. Louis so easily if we're situated right down here near the river. And Francois Chouteau and his community of French-speaking fur traders did so over near Randolph. And then 1826, along came a flood. Their operation is kiboshed right there.
Tell me about that flood of 1826.
It rose. It was little recorded because there were only a few score European Americans here who had anything to record. But Francois Chouteau and his group definitely felt it and said, we got to get out of this area near Randolph. Let's move upstream and to higher ground. And so they did, closer to the mouth of the Kaw River, where they stayed until the flood of 1844. By then, the commercial development of the town of Kansas, plotted out by a group of real estate developers and early settlers, was sitting down near the river, and the river came up, And it's one of its believed to be the highest in Kansas City history, although records at the time were not as well kept, ran up warehouses, made lots of people move farther up and farther away from the river. More levees were needed and so forth with the, you know, tools they had to build them. That flood in 1844 persuaded a lot of shippers that Independence was no longer a good place to land their steamboats because Independence Landing had become a mud flats. Kansas City had a rocky shelf that protruded out, and when the waters went down, there was a rocky shelf again. What a great pier, what a great key into the river. And steamboats migrated more and more there, and so more and more shipping means more and more for the warehouseman, more commerce, and it just got the critical mass going for Kansas City.
So that location of downtown Kansas City, really, some other places had been kind of tried out.
In a sense, that had been experimented with, and the location turned out to be a fortunate one. It was close enough, on higher enough ground, that rocky shelf where a steamboat could land, that hotels could go there, warehouses could go there, people could live and work and make money there. The various trails that left here, the Oregon Trail, Santa Fe Trail, and other stuff, which were either the Oregon Trail took families and the Santa Fe Trail took merchandise. It was a great place to land right there. So that acreage that the guys who had invented the town of Kansas purchased was perfect. Like a lot of real estate, they were very lucky.
Well, so we've heard about some really early floods and how they shaped even just where Kansas City is, not even like specific features of Kansas City. But the flood of 51 is really a huge one, and it's also probably the oldest flood that people today can remember. What happened and how did people respond to it in terms of urban design? Let's stick with what happened first.
You heard the dramatic description of the rains out west, the Smoky Hill and the Saline and the high water moved down the Kansas or Kaw River. Junction City, I believe, was flooded. Manhattan was flooded.
When you say flooded, I mean, some of the descriptions I've read from people who remember it, this is dramatic. This is, you know, I don't know, just huge disaster caliber stuff.
Especially if they had a business or a house in the lowlands. As you know, floods don't just knock on the door and crash down the door necessarily. The water rises, and that was what also happened in Topeka, and then Lawrence, and then down the river it came. Finally, despite the efforts of a lot of emergency workers to sandbag the Kaw River over in the Argentine area to the west, the water seeped through. It came through there, and then on July, I believe, 13th, it came through in the stockyards themselves. Armourdale was underwater, and there were a lot of people who lived in Armourdale.
Submerged, right?
Right, and a lot of people who lived in the packing plants. A lot of houses were washed away. Some were never found. Argentine, where a lot of people worked in the Santa Fe Railroad yards. And then, of course, the West Bottoms, where a lot of the economic engine that had driven Kansas City for decades and decades was. Well, it was decommissioned. The stockyards underwater.
Are there still like watermarks on structures today? Like, can you see the signs of this water that rose so high?
There's a fabulous one on a church in the Argentine area, a stone church whose name I can't remember right now, but you can go to it. And there's a mark. We haven't mentioned the 1903 flood. That was a big thing. But there's a mark, a brass plaque that says, here's where the 1903 flood was. Way up above that, almost beyond vision, is a mark saying, here's where the 51 flood came. It was big.
The 51 flood, one of the descriptions that I've heard involves, you know, cemeteries flooding. And is that something that really happened, or is that just someone's recollection getting imaginative?
Most memorably, it happened in the 1993 flood. There was a cemetery near Hardin, Missouri, where the caskets actually came up and began floating away.
Wow.
Any cemetery in the lowlands, anything in the lowlands, is going to be affected by the flood. And the lowlands, of course, is the path of the river as it goes back and forth over the centuries and the millennia, carving this area. It leaves itself a nice flat area of nice soil, good for farming, but bad for flooding.
How long was this going on? I mean, how long was Kansas City just living in this state of being submerged and not knowing when it was going to stop or how?
Typically, these floods last about a week before they finally, the water evacuates downstream. In 1993, flooding happened in July, and it happened again in August. There was bouts of floods, all depending on the rainfall and where it fell.
Back to this flood of 51, though, how did people respond to it in terms of urban design?
For one thing, that was about when the advent of air conditioning had come along. But if you couldn't get cool water, especially in the early air conditioning types in movie theaters and stuff, it was difficult to run the air conditioning. The water plant, one of the Kansas City's water plants, was inundated. Fortunately, another one survived it. But urban design, the biggest part of urban design I can think of is the meatpacking plants, which were a major smoky element and a job creator, a job producer down in the West Bottoms that gave them a large part of the impetus they needed to just leave town.
To go to the smaller towns in rural areas, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Man, I've heard that the airport moved north of the city as the result of that flood, and I had always wondered why we put our airport so far away from our downtown. It seems that flooding is why. I mean, the airport had once been much closer to these areas you're describing.
We're talking about the airport that was in the Fairfax District, which is now part of Kansas City, Kansas. It hadn't been incorporated then. That's where TWA had its overhaul base, and there was a landing strip and a little terminal and a tower and things. And that was flooded by virtue of a levee breaking and a sewer line breaking in 1951 after the West Bottoms had gone underwater. There are scenes and photographs of the inside of the TWA overhaul base, and it's just a muddy mess. You can see why they'd say, we're leaving here, we're going to some place where there's higher ground, and the higher ground they found was in near Platte City.
So yeah, that's why the airport is where it is. That's wild. And then there's the flood of 77. That's another big one that comes after 51. I was an infant during that flood, and my family lost a lot of photographs because, as the legend goes anyway, the basement filled completely with water, and apparently I, as an infant, was put upstairs and just hope for the best. But, you know, what do you remember about the flood of 77?
That a lot of basements were flooded. Not only homes in the basin of Brush Creek and Rock Creek and the Blue River, but also businesses in the Country Club Plaza. It's remembered as the Plaza Flood because this was this big commercial district, Kansas City's main high-end retail district at that time in 1977. And windows were broken out, cars were washed away, diners at the Alameda Plaza restaurant were looked down and couldn't believe what they saw.
Was there any warning of this flood? I mean, did people see it coming?
It was an unexpected dump of rain upstream. There had been days of flooding around Kansas City, and surely the ground was packed with moisture. But there's unexpected, kind of almost like a micro storm that occurred upstream that just drove this thing. And I want to mention also that most of the deaths, the 20-some-odd deaths attributed to the flood, and a lot of the economic damage happened downstream in the less well-known areas along the Blue River. And so the Corps of Engineers and the city, and Corinne, I'm sure, can talk about all this, did a lot of changes to Brush Creek and the Blue River to make those, to try at least to make those flow smoother.
But why was it that area flooded primarily?
Because the rain fell there. Just as in 51, the rain fell upstream on the Kaw and its tributaries, and in 1903, the rain fell upriver on the Missouri.
So what changed after the flood of 77? I mean, did that, you just alluded to some change. Any others that you want to point out that are significant?
The change in Brush Creek is quite significant. What used to be a concrete drainage ditch, essentially, became this place with wrought iron fences and railings, and people can run and walk along it and other stuff. That was a major change that you could drive across the bridge on Troost here and see the change. Volcker Fountain was moved.
Do you think that did people stop building new shopping areas in this area because of the flood? I mean, could Zona Rosa be where it is for the same reason that the airport is where it is?
Oh, it could be, but the Country Club Plaza fought back right away. Some of the shops were reopened within weeks. Again, it was this notion of the Kansas City spirit, which had arisen after the convention hall fire at the turn of the century and then was illustrated by Norman Rockwell at the behest of Joyce Hall after the 1951 flood, the guy rolling up his sleeves with a bunch of plans, getting ready to go rebuild, the idea of the Kansas City spirit.
Well, Rockwell painted that in response to the 51 flood?
That's right.
Yeah.
Commissioned by Joyce Hall.
Wow.
In a sense, that same kind of spirit, if that kind of thing really exists, happened right after the Plaza flood, when all along the Brush Creek and the Blue River commercial rebuilding took place.
And of course, we've alluded to the flood of 93. Lots of generations of listeners can recall that one. Tell me about that flood. What caused it and how did it play out?
The major word for Kansas City after that, during that flood, was, phew, we made it. The water came up within a foot or so of the top of the flood wall. But upriver along the Missouri, downriver along the Missouri, I mentioned the Hardin Cemetery farms were inundated with sand and things, removing them from agriculture. There were lots of rural problems with that flood. Also, St. Louis was flooded. A lot of that happened. Kansas City escaped the worst of it because the dikes, the levees held.
But there were some really tragic events in the West Bottoms, if I remember correctly.
In the flood of 93, this I don't remember off the top of my head.
Oh, okay. Just it seems like the few maybe artists who were down there, and it wasn't highly populated at the time, but I seem to remember that there were a couple of tragedies in the West Bottoms.
Well, because no one knew how high the water would go, there were evacuations of businesses in the West Bottoms and homes in Armourdale also.
Well, so can you understand the story of Kansas City without taking floods into account? I mean, is this a crucial part of who we are and how we behave as people who travel around and use the geography the way we do?
I think it's a part. Anytime a flood sticks in memory, in your memory, the 77 and the 93 floods, and there was one in 98, too, that killed a lot of people on the Prospect Bridge over Brush Creek, these things stay in our memory. And we also remember if we're down near a stream when we're buying a house, we might want to think twice before doing that.
Monroe Dodd, stay with me through the break. Later in the show, we'd love to hear how you remember Kansas City's major or even minor floods. Has a structure or community in your neighborhood been affected by flooding in a surprising way? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. I've been chatting with resident historian and all-around good guy Monroe Dodd about historic floods that have shaped Kansas City. Hi again, Monroe.
You're too kind, Gina. Hi.
There's something that it seems like we haven't quite touched on enough, which is the environmental impact of the 1903 flood.
Because the West Bottoms was the nerve center of Kansas City in 1903, and because Kansas City by then had, the metro area had grown to surpass 200,000 people, that was a big flood that a lot of people noticed. It happened largely in the West Bottoms. I believe it was as much a Missouri River as a Kaw River flood, but it affected the electric power plant, which cut off electricity for a week to the city, and it also meant that streetcars couldn't run. They were mostly electrified by 1903. Streetcars were really important because few people owned automobiles. It affected the gas works. Out goes natural gas, which is sometimes used for lighting then, and certainly for heating and cooking. It affected the waterworks, and so goes fresh water. Hard to find then. You got to boil everything. All those things that had been in the West Bottoms and had been vulnerable to flooding were out, and suddenly people said, we need to do a bunch of different things. One, the railroads decided they would, as I mentioned, move Union Depot. There needed to be backups to the waterworks, a different place to generate electric power and so forth. And we need better flood walls. Kansas invented a thing called the Kaw Valley Drainage District, which is a very humdrum-sounding name, but the point of it was to build levees and walls along the Kansas River in hopes of preventing a flood like that in the future. Didn't survive 50 years, but that was the hope.
Wow. In just a moment, we'll hear from an engineer who's been involved in water management systems since that last big one, the last big flood, that is. But first, let's visit a little-known community on the river. It's called Harlem, and it's less than 5 minutes from downtown Kansas City. This once bustling river town played a pivotal role in the development of Kansas City, but now it's nearly abandoned, and floods have a lot to do with that. KCUR's Lee Burmish takes us there.
On a rainy July morning, Art Homer takes me on a drive through the streets of his hometown. Homer was born in Harlem in 1940. And lived here until he was 11.
And where you see that big pile of rock, that's where the school was at.
In its heyday, this 50-acre town was home to nearly 600 people. Today, it looks like a ghost town. Most of its original structures have been torn down, leaving just three homes, a handful of businesses, a church, and a former Holiday Inn converted into apartments. Down the road on North Main Street, Homer taps the inside of his driver's window in the direction of a small tan house.
Aunt that lived here in this vacant area. This is one of about three homes that are left in Harlem here.
The path up to the front door has disappeared into the unkempt lawn, and a canopy of trees engulfs the second floor. A beware of the dog sign nailed to a wood pole is proof that this house once had an owner. Harlem is just across the river from downtown, but Homer says the property hasn't exactly been sought after.
The thing I heard all my life was that they're going to take Harlem over eventually, so hold on to your property. It's going to be worth a whole lot. Well, that didn't really ever happen.
Harlem was Harlem when Kansas City was Westport Landing.
That's Charles Broomfield. He was born in Harlem in 1937. While doing research for a book about his hometown, Broomfield discovered that Harlem predates Kansas City. The first settlers came from the Netherlands during the mid-1820s, Broomfield says. They named Harlem after a city in the Netherlands, like the Harlem in New York City. A ferryboat landing quickly turned the settlement into a center of commerce.
You know, the railroads brought merchandise, produce, goods of every kind and color. So Harlem contributed to the growth of Kansas City by being the place where the railroads offloaded those goods.
But once the Hannibal Bridge opened across the Missouri River in 1869, people didn't need the ferryboats anymore. Then in 1911, a second bridge opened, the ASB Bridge, and it created a direct link from downtown Kansas City to North Kansas City. Soon, almost everyone was bypassing Harlem. And then there were the floods. Broomfield was 14 when the major flood of 1951 hit.
Policemen came through Harlem with loudspeakers and said, "Evacuate immediately. The levee is going to break and everything's going to be flooded."
His family loaded up what they could fit in their pickup truck and escaped north for a week. Broomfield's family returned, but many others didn't. The 100-year-old Harlem Baptist Church closed in 2006, but now it's one of the few signs of life here.
My name is Gabriel. I'm the pastor of this church.
Pastor Gabriel Riak and the majority of his congregants are from South Sudan. Today, the congregation is non-denominational. Riak was looking for a place to worship in 2012 when he came across the vacant building.
I like the location, the space.
They've grown to about 100 members, but none of them live in Harlem, Riak says. There aren't a lot of places to live in Harlem. The apartment complex that used to be a Holiday Inn houses the majority of Harlem residents. Steve Jones is one of them. He moved in about a month ago and says it's not a good place, but it's cheap.
Man, look, if I knew it was like that, I probably wouldn't be down there.
The complex was the site of two homicides so far this year. Jones is skeptical the neighborhood will turn around.
I mean, I can see people moving in with their families, and it might turn into something. But that's if you got that type of people in there. Right now, they got drug addicts, sex offenders, and all that type of stuff down there, so it's kind of scary down there.
Harlem was annexed by Kansas City in 1950. While much of the land has been bought by the small businesses, Broomfield says the area has a lot of potential for development.
It would be an excellent place to build apartments, an entertainment district, condominiums, a shopping area.
Just across the river, a 275-unit apartment development is slated to be completed by fall of 2016, and its construction is a sign that people are starting to see value in riverfront living. That change in attitude could help to revitalize Harlem's side of the river one day, but it will probably never be the Harlem Broomfield knew.
We swam in the river when we were kids. We climbed on the bridges. We were relatively poor people, frankly, didn't know it, didn't realize it, but I'd love to go back and grow up there again.
For now, Harlem will get some recognition as a town that helped Kansas City grow. A historical marker will be erected in the fall, and Broomfield, along with other former residents, will be there to dedicate it.
That was Lee Burmish taking us to Kansas City's Harlem, which brings us to the future of riverside neighborhoods in Kansas City. We've heard about huge floods that make people rightfully cautious of putting too many hopes and dreams in low-lying floodplains by rivers and creeks. But are these areas as dangerous as they used to be? And if not, could they see a renaissance? Let's hear from Karen Jacoby. She's an attorney working on levees and flood protection for Hush Blackwell, and she's also a registered engineer with experience in waterway management. Her firm will be hosting a levee and flood protection conversation next Wednesday. Welcome to Central Standard, Karen.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And excuse me, your name is Corinne.
Yes, that's correct.
Do you think changes in flood management could affect the way we use different parts of the city moving forward?
I do. There's things that have happened locally. There's also things that are happening nationally that inform those decisions. I came here in 95, so soon after the 93 flood, and began working on the waterways here. And shortly thereafter, work began on a large stormwater management plan. And that has a number of policies in place that will keep the things that happened and occurred that resulted in localized flooding from occurring again. So already we've seen a change there in the manifestation of it.
So what can we get a little bit more specific? First of all,
sure.
When you talk about localized flooding, can you define that?
Okay, so we talked about the Kansas River flood, the 1951 flood. That was more of a regional. It was a large flood over a large area. Localized flooding, we would see that more along Brush Creek, Turkey Creek, Blue River. So those areas where you have more influence from the development that occurs that can increase the peak flows from the encroachments onto the waterways. So those things have changed.
Before we get into what's changed, what systems had been in place when you arrived in 1995, or even before the flood of 1993? How was the system of levees and flood water management, how was all of that working?
Well, the levees had been in place for a while, as was mentioned earlier, and a lot of levees grew up over time. They started out sometimes as agricultural levees to protect farmland. Development grew behind them. They were reinforced over time. That happened a lot along the Missouri River with work by the Corps of Engineers, and the 1944 Pick-Sloan Plan gave rise to a lot of that.
And what is the Pick-Sloan Plan?
That was a plan by the Corps of Engineers and I think the Bureau of Land Management that led to, that was passed by Congress, and the Corps and the Bureau couldn't agree on what should happen for a long time on the Missouri River there.
Are there two basic sides to that debate?
Not that I could speak to. I'm not really familiar with the argument, but I know that there was disagreement, and they finally came together, and the Pick-Sloan was authorized by Congress. And then that's when a lot of the levees and flood protection defenses along the Missouri River began moving forward.
So when you arrived in 1995, what were your original thoughts just looking at what was going on in Kansas City? And what were your thoughts about what we were doing well and where we could maybe use a new way of thinking or a new approach?
Well, I was really fascinated when I came here with the Brush Creek area. It's a wonderful civil engineering work that changes the landscape and serves a purpose. And it's a flood control and beautification project with the purpose of economic generation. And I think you spoke to that earlier. And in the case of Brush Creek, you have a project that was funded nearly equally by the Corps or the federal government, some transportation dollars, and the city to the tune of $130 million or so that has generated over $1 billion in economic investment along that corridor. But for those flood improvements, then the reinvestment in this region along this corridor in the plaza east and west of there could not have occurred. So
in 1995, you arrived. What are some of the projects that you've been involved with since then that have really changed the picture?
Well, we talked about earlier the 1951 flood and how the levees came close to overtopping and some of the concerns there. So when I came here, the conversation was, as you said, we made it, but what's going to happen next time? And, we really need to come back and take a look at this levee system that protects the Kansas City area, including the Kaw Valley system along the Kansas River, the Fairfax Drainage District area, the central industrial district area, or the West Bottoms, as we sometimes call it, and look at how all of those different levees function as a system together to protect the Kansas City urban area there.
Had they previously been sort of viewed in a one-off kind of way, like this levee either is or isn't working for this area?
Well, there were different drivers for whenever they were developed, and they weren't all authorized, designed, and constructed as a system. They grew up, as much flood protection defensive have, rather organically. The Kaw Valley Drainage District after the 51 flood. Fairfax had their projects and these others. So while they were designed, there was thought given to what was else was happening. But as far as how they worked together as a whole system, that analysis hadn't been done. And really the technology, the water modeling, the geotechnical understanding, and a lot of the tools that we use to look at levees as systems now weren't available to us when they were originally installed.
So you've seen a change in going from thinking about levees individually to levees as a complete system, and then also some technological advances. Are there any other things that you saw that Kansas City needed in 1995 that we either have or haven't gotten?
Well, you know, there's a I'm going to kind of veer away from that a little bit and say I think Kansas City is and their decisions are informed by its flood history, and they strive to be resilient in the face of flooding. And to do that, you need to be prepared for it. So there's always more to learn and always more that can be done. So were there things that needed to be done? You know, with every new flood event, we learn something else that can be done or can be done better. The stormwater management policies that we have, the stream buffer ordinance about pushing development away from the waterways, those are all relatively new things. They're good things, and they're on the right path. So, but is there more that can be done? We're looking at the Kansas City levee system now, do an analysis on that. There's improvements that need to be made. Some are underway. Some are yet to be authorized by Congress. So
a lot of the events that we've heard touched the West Bottoms and Argentine neighborhoods in particular. When you think about those neighborhoods today, have the developments in water management and flood management, do those changes make those neighborhoods safer in the face of major rain events?
Well, I'm not intimately familiar with those particular neighborhoods. And most of my work has been in the Kansas City, Missouri side, where I have more knowledge. But the improvements that are being made and the analysis that's been done on the Kansas City levees system is leading to identifying those projects that need to be put in place in order to make those areas safer.
We'd love to hear how you remember Kansas City's floods. Has a structure or community you know of been affected by flooding in a surprising way? And is there a riverside spot you'd like to see revived? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888. Monroe Dodd, historian, is everything Corinne's been saying about new developments in flood management a continuation of Kansas City's relationship with water and flooding, or are you picking up on a departure?
No, I was just thinking of Francois Chouteau and his fur agency in 1826 would be shocked at what must be computer modeling, hydrologic modeling, all the stuff that goes on to prevent flooding today. One of the outcomes of the 51 flood was all those reservoirs up the Kansas River. And if you've ever boated on Perry or Milford or any number of other lakes, those aren't there for boating. It's nice to have boating, but they're there to hold the water back. To believe in 1826 or even 1844 or 1903 that all this stuff could be managed that way, it's surprising to think about, but so true.
Corinne, what is the technology like?
Oh, well, it is looking not just at the height of the levees, you know, which initially is where we started. And, you know, how high do you need to build this flood wall or this levee to keep the water on the riverside? But now there's a lot more understanding of how that water moves underneath the levees and through the soils and what type, how do you relieve the pressures that build up on those levees and flood walls? And look at all that. It just really started out as the elevation. Now it's the structure as a whole.
Wow. Well, Monroe, do you see possibilities for Kansas City's future that wouldn't have been considered options in the past because of flooding?
Possibilities for Kansas City's future, maybe so. High ground is always a possibility. After the flood of 1903, a guy named William Strang came to visit his mother, who lived here, and all the news was about the big flood. And he decided to put his real estate developments that he wanted to start out on high ground in Johnson County, a real estate development named Overland Park. And if you shop or you live in Overland Park today, it's, as you know, it's the driver of Johnson County. And it is the direct result of that flood. So there's a policy, an economic developer's policy.
Central Standard has to take one last break. When we return, we'll be taking your calls, flood memories and riverfront dreams. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Okay, we've got just a little time left, so let's get right to it. I'm Gina Kaufman here with historian Monroe Dodd and attorney Corinne Jacoby, who's also an engineer. She's been involved in Kansas City's levee systems management since 1995. We're learning how floods have shaped the city we live in today and how new developments could be changing conventional wisdom about where to build and where not to. Could be. We'll find out. Let's go to some of our callers at 816-235-2888. We've got Paulina in Kansas City on the line. Hi, Paulina.
Hi there. I remembered two particular floods. One, the Armadale, which my grandfather worked for Santa Fe when that flood took place. My mother and my grandparents moved to Kansas City, Missouri, where I reside now, up on the upper level of the west side of Kansas City, Missouri. And that's, I remember that, my parents talking about that, that particular flood. But the one I witnessed was the flood on the plaza. I worked for Macy's when that flood took place. And I lived two blocks from Macy's, up on the hill off of Summit and Southwest Traffic Way. That morning after the flood, it was two storms on top of each other, one over the other. The rain was humongously bad. The thing is that that following day, I went down just to see what it looked like. It was like a sight out of the Twilight Zone. There were mannequins on the floor because the water was so impactful, it busted some of the windows of the stores, Swanson's and Hartsfeld's and Macy's, some of the well-established stores there. It was just a nightmare to see. It looked like a true disaster. Also, too, there were cars stuck up in trees. That's how powerful that rain was. There were people that tried to reach the second level of the upper garage areas. Some of them had drowned just being in their car trying to escape. But it was a sight I will never forget. But seeing that was a true devastation, and that's when the Brush Creek came into being and saying, okay, how can we stop something like this? It was a very unusual storm. It was not like a regular storm, but I recall them saying it was like a storm on top of a storm. It was just endowed with rain. I did have friends who were working that night, who worked at the bars, and everybody thought, well, it's just a huge storm. All of a sudden, rain was coming through their doors there at the bar. People were thinking, okay, what's happening? And the next thing they knew is that the bartenders were saying, you know, everybody needs to leave. And
yeah. Thank you so much for that call, Paulina. It sounds surreal. Monroe, what do you know about this storm on top of a storm thing? Any ideas from weather reports at the time?
I was working at the Kansas City Star that night for the old Kansas City Times, and I remember hearing a photographer who had been assigned to the scene report that manhole covers were blowing off the sewers because the water was so high. That's what we knew. I had a relative who watched cars float away from the sanctity of the rooftop restaurant at the Alameda.
Let's hear from Joe Bridges in Liberty, Missouri. Hi, Joe. Excuse me.
Hi.
Yes, hi. Go on.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I've been involved with the Clay County Public Health. I'm retired now. But I have been to meetings at the Missouri City Schools, which is east of Liberty, about 7 or 8 miles. And in the 93 flood, they were completely flooded out, the school. Their school is the smallest school district in the United States. There's only 41 students in the district. And the site for a new library and information building was in the mix. And Luxembourg, the country of Luxembourg, heard about the flood in Missouri City and paid for a brand new building to be built in Missouri City with next to part of the school. It's a stone structure, the old structure. And it has a big sign on the side of it that says Luxembourg. And it's built like a chalet. So if you ever go to Missouri City, you'll see what the country of Luxembourg did for Missouri City.
Well, wow. Thanks for that call, Joe. That's Monroe, is that a story you've heard before? What a huge event for a lot of people, but a small community, you know?
All the way down the Missouri River in 93, there were small communities that were affected that way. People who lived in houses, trailer homes, and other things that could basically just swim into their house and through their house. Yes, lots of little communities were affected that way.
Corinne, when you hear these stories, I mean, what do you hear as a person with engineering knowledge? I mean, the rest of us hear them from just a totally human perspective. Not that engineering isn't human, but you know what I mean.
Okay. You know, certainly the tragedy is, you know, the first thing that comes across in all these instances. But then, you know, the next thing you wonder, you know, what can you do to keep it from happening again? And how do you understand what happened is the first part of that. And you talked about the flood on top of the flood. And we talked earlier about technical modeling. You know, initially the modeling that was available to understand what was happening in something like Brush Creek, it just wasn't that advanced. And new hydraulic models have allowed it to be better understood. When Brush Creek was initially designed, it was there was a physical model that was built, a scale model, and water was run through that to understand how it would behave. Things have advanced beyond that, which allows the design of flood protection defenses to be put in place.
Let's talk to Brian and Shawnee. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Gina. Great topic. I'm so glad you're talking about it. I have an observation and a question for your engineer particularly. I have some friends in Omaha and in Omaha, Nebraska, which is on the Missouri River. They boat on it. There's marinas and infrastructure where people can engage the river. And just recently driving through Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I see that Sioux Falls, South Dakota, there's marinas and infrastructure there. And I'm just wondering, you know, Kansas City, we turn our back to our river, and these other cities that are not very far away, 100 miles by water or less, are engaging the river and using it for sporting and boating and generating economic stuff. What would the feasibility of putting something like a marina, or that kind of infrastructure, on our current Missouri River area, would that be feasible?
I think that it is feasible, and there are some places where you can access the river. Call Point Park has done some work recently right there at the junction of the Kansas and the Missouri rivers that allow access to the river.
And you get there through Fairfax, kind of?
Yes, uh-huh. And, you know, there's nice facilities there. I think when people start making more use of those and there's more demand for it, then more of those things will occur.
How do you demonstrate demand for it?
Well, if there are people putting in and taking out boats at the ramps that are in place already, if people are out at these places that are on the riverfront and spending their days there, if there's activities there that draw them to those places and they relate more with those waterways. We've started seeing some of that along Brush Creek. You know, you see a lot of walkers and bicyclists making use of those pathways.
Corinne, looking forward, what are some of the big challenges or puzzles that you find yourself and other people who are really immersed in questions of waterway management and flood water management? What are the challenges that really, I would almost say, inspire you or have you kind of wringing your hands, possibly?
Well, I talked earlier about how much technology is advanced in the hydraulic modeling and the information that we use to understand what happens when the water actually gets into the channel or into the river. One of the big questions now is how much water is going to get there and when. And this is being driven by the conversation on climate change and how much water. We began the conversation with a lot of water fell in Kansas, and this caused the Kansas River flood. So trying to understand what's going to happen into the future with respect to these storm events is really where a lot of the conversation is taking place now. It's moving from just looking at the historical record to determine what's going to happen in the future to considering what we know about climate change and can predict about the future as far as how much flooding will occur in a given area.
So how do things look in your crystal ball?
Murky. And this is a really, really tough question. You know, we've all heard about the sea level rise. You know, a lot of work has been done already on sea level rise, and there's some good information there. When you look at riverine systems like where we are, the Missouri, the Mississippi, the Kansas rivers, there's less known about how the riverine systems are going to respond and what the effect of climate change in those areas is going to be. So a lot of unknowns still.
Let's talk to Tom in the West Bottoms. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing, Gina?
Good. How about you?
Good. Hey, I just wanted to thank you for this topic. It's a great topic, and mention the Turkey Creek Project, which has provided a big economic incentive for the bi-state area along Southwest Boulevard.
What is the Turkey Creek Project?
Well, that's a flood control project that Corinne is familiar with, and the area news broadcasting organizations seem to be kind of dejected now. They go down on Southwest Boulevard during big rain events, and they can't find a flooding creek anymore. And it's really helped all those restaurants and businesses along Southwest Boulevard. That project's about 85% complete. And while it doesn't provide 100% protection, all these projects are designed to mitigate flood risk so that the residual risk can be managed. But it's a great example of the Corps and the two cities working together, and Corinne can probably talk more about that.
Corinne, why don't you? Tell us about the Turkey Creek Project and how it's influenced the Southwest Boulevard corridor.
Well, the Turkey Creek, it's a localized flood project, and it's another creek where the kind of like with Brush Creek that has a very rapid to rise and very swift water, so very dangerous in an urban area. And we've seen that over the years along Southwest Boulevard, similar to what we'd seen in the Plaza area and then down at Prospect. Not with the same number of fatalities, but certainly those similar challenges. Southwest Boulevard would flood, and for a while it was happening, you know, on a 3 to 5 year recurrence interval. And there were a number of studies that were done, and just about when the Corps of Engineers thought they had the answer, there would be another flood. A railroad car would get washed into the channel, and having to figure out what impact that had and how to move forward. We'd have to go back and look at it again. But it eventually got to the point where it was well understood what was happening and what needed to be done to fix it was move forward and authorization, and construction began in the early 2000s. I'm not sure the exact year. And it's been moving forward. It's about a $100 million project. Great, as Tom said, deal of cooperation between Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri, and the Corps of Engineers to remove the repeated flooding that happens kind of through that region, and has allowed it now for many years to continue to prosper without the severity of floods. But you were talking about markers earlier. I remember, and I assume that it's still there, in Ponax Restaurant along Southwest Boulevard, you'll see a number of markers on one of the walls showing the numerous flood events that have occurred there.
You mentioned cooperation between Kansas and Missouri, the two sides. I mean, water doesn't care about our political boundaries. Has cooperation been an issue in Kansas City, just having two political entities?
Well, you know, there's some challenges with it, but there's also benefits with it because these projects are expensive and, it takes a lot of support to move them forward. Both at the local and at the federal level. So having that bi-state cooperation is really an advantage whenever the authorizations or appropriations are sought from the federal government in order to put these kind of projects in place. And we have wonderful working relationships on Kansas City Levees Project and on Turkey Creek.
Monroe, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking about how history bears on the Southwest Boulevard corridor. If I'm not mistaken, Turkey Creek long, long ago ran down that way,
That's
which is
correct.
Why it wants to go back that way or wanted to go back that way.
That's true.
Our time is up for this morning's conversations. I'm amazed by just the huge impact flooding has had on this city. If you're interested in learning more about the future of our waterways, Corinne Jacoby's firm Hush Blackwell is hosting a conversation about our levees and flood protection next Wednesday, August 12th. You can get the details on their website, hushblackwell.com. Corinne, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, and thank you for covering this topic. I enjoyed it.
And Monroe Dodd, thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You can listen back to the discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the food critics will be here talking about who does a good brunch in this town. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Lots of help from Matt Hodapp today. And special thanks to Lee Burmish. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.